All I would like to say is that the University of Chicago Law Review, which is going to be publishing the papers, and the law school faculty have had a very unique collaboration now for about 8 or 9 years that I've been privileged to be involved with. Each spring or early summer, just before Father's Day, we have a conference like this, and each year, without exception, 3 months late, the volume for the conferences happens to come out. The first of these conferences in 2003, I think Mark was at that conference on ex post and ex ante, if I'm not mistaken. We talked about intellectual property, and now we've come back to that particular cycle again 7 years later. It's been a wonderful run through the law review and so forth. The format is to have everything short and punchy, relatively short presentation, relatively intensive questioning. And since you're ready to talk, my dear, I will be ready to sit down, and I'd just like to thank everybody. Dan, you're here, right? So the lawyer, you guys sitting there in the back, and if you have any questions about why your paper is too long and how to cut it, he's the man to talk to. But other than that, I think we're really ready to go. And the question we're going to talk about first is whether increased disclosure will help. The answer is obviously no, but now we're going to find out why.
Okay, so I can hear you, but I guess that's okay. Well, first of all, thank you. I'm terribly sorry that I can't be there. I am too awfully close to my due date, and I can't travel anymore. And I don't think it'd be good for me to travel because I'd go crazy in a plane 2 hours sitting down. But I'm glad that technology has allowed me to be here, and I really look forward to your comments. And I guess I should start the presentation where it is. Well, the topic of my talk is increase disclosure help? And the paper that I present examines the main approach of the ALI's recently approved principles of the law of software contracts. So I will start with a brief background. So as many of you know, the law of software contracts is in disarray and has been for quite some time. In the past couple of decades, we've witnessed conflicting case law and differing academic views regarding important aspects of software contracting, such as what constitutes contract formation and what is the right relationship, or what is the relationship between federal intellectual property law and state contract law. There were several attempts to harmonize the law in this area, but these efforts failed mostly due to differing views, again, about what should be, or disagreements over what should be the right set of rules to govern these transactions. Particularly, there was a perception that the proposals that have come forward were too seller-friendly and afforded consumers very little protection. So, of course, the problem with uncertainty is that it increases the cost of doing business for both buyers and sellers alike. And in the slides, I've listed some of the failed attempt. Well, now enter the ALI's new principles of the law of software contracts. In May 2009, the ALI approved these new principles again with the goal of creating some certainty in this area. Now, unlike predecessors, the drafters of the principles starts from the assumption that market forces are insufficient to discipline sellers into offering reasonable terms. And this seems like a very reasonable assumption, particularly in the context of mass market retail. If less than a critical number of buyers are informed or sensitive to terms, that is, absent an informed minority of buyers, sellers who are otherwise unconstrained by reputation or the threat of litigation might not find it worthwhile to offer reasonable terms. So the drafters of the principles identify lack of access or an insufficient notice as the main cause of this failure to read, and they note in the text that perhaps the most serious problem that deters reading in this context, singled out by many commentators and highlighted in litigation, is the manner of presenting terms. So the proposed solution is to increase contract disclosure to promote reading and shopping for terms, and thus the creation an informed minority of buyers. The principles offer a series of best practices regarding contract disclosure that, if followed, would ensure enforcement of terms. For instance, one provision requires software vendors, whether they sell the software online or not, to post their terms in a reasonably accessible manner on a website. And the provision that I'm particularly interested in is one that requires sellers who sell their software online, that's the majority of sellers, to use click wraps, that is, to present their contract in a scroll box with a text next to the I agree icon that the buyer must agree to in order to continue with the checkout process. Of course, the disclosure regulation and the principles approach is clearly preferred to more intrusive or direct regulation because it preserves consumer choice and it doesn't create that many distortions. The problem is, what if it doesn't work? So what I do in this paper is I examine the question of whether increased contract disclosure in the manner prescribed by the principles will actually significantly increase readership and create an informed minority of buyers. This is one of the main goals of the principles and disclosure regulation, yet there's been surprisingly little empirical investigation of this question, particularly in the context of EULAs. So what I do is a very simple test. I estimate contract readership as a function of contract disclosure by tracking the clickstream of software shoppers online to various vendors and see whether these shoppers are more likely to read when these contracts are more prominently disclosed. So my sample consists of all the internet visits by 47,399 households to 81 retail software companies for 1 month, who sell their software online, make their software available online, and who also make their EULAs, the contract associated with the software, available somewhere on the website. And the data track, all the sequence, the clickstream, which is the sequence of URLs, as well as the time spent on each URL. So this is the data that allows us to see this. And then for each company, we also collect all the URLs that correspond to EULAs, because that allows me to see whether they click on them or not, and also how long they spent on the EULA, because this allows me to create a proxy for whether they read it or how long they spent on, get a sense of how much they understood or how much they read by seeing how long they spent on the contract. And then for each EULA, I also classify their accessibility as either a click wrap, as I said, where you have to click on I agree, or a browse wrap, which is when the EULA is available somewhere on the site as a hyperlink, and browse wraps require buyers to voluntarily seek these contracts out and access them. I also have a very conservative definition of who a reader is. I say that a reader is anyone who clicks on a EULA page and stays on it for at least 1 second. So I guess, again, I'm being extremely conservative in my definitions. So here's a quick example of the type of, there's two types of click wraps, turns out, and I want to make sure that I make a distinction. This is the one that drafters of the principles recommend. This is the most salient type of disclosure. There's a, so I can't point with my finger, but I hope you see my mouse. During the checkout process with the click wrap EULA, the seller requires the buyer to fill in all sorts of personal information. And at the end, while they're checking out, the text of the license appears in a box. It's unavoidable. And it also requires an explicit action from the buyer. The other type of click wrap, which is also very common, and I will analyze them separately, is one that is exactly the same as before, but instead of having the text of the EULA in a scroll box, it appears in a hyperlink that requires the buyer to actually click once more to access the EULA. So So in the former example, I can't really see whether people voluntarily access yoga, so I'll analyze those separately. Now I'm gonna present some results. So this very simple table measures readership as a function of accessibility. In the leftmost column, I've divided companies by the type of accessibility they have. Companies that offer click wraps and companies that offer browse wraps. Browse wraps are the contracts that are more hidden. The next column tells us the number of company visits to each of these different types of companies, and then some statistics about the nature of the visit. The more interesting findings are in the right side of the column, because it tells us, it gives us an information about those visits where there was a EULA access. Why don't we go first through like the browse wraps, which are the contracts that are the least accessible. So what I do here is, what we can see is that there were 40,697 company visits, and the mean number of pages accessed were 35, and the median number of pages accessed were 14. Now, interestingly, out of these 40,697, only 36, or 0.09, had a EULA visit. So the number is really, really low. Again, this might be consistent with the view that perhaps these contracts are very, very hard to find. The number is almost zero. The hope of the drafters and anyone who is promoting disclosure regulation is that as you make contracts more accessible, the number of readers will actually go up. So if we move to click wraps, where buyers are basically given no choice but to acknowledge the license, we can see that we have 3,000 visits here. And out of those, only 7 or 0.23% chose to click on the hyperlink and check the EULA. So what this says is that for the type of click wraps where there's a hyperlink next to the agree box, only 7 out of about 3,000 decided to, they're making me agree to something, I might as well see what it is. So nobody does. The most striking finding, again, is that the increase in readership from going from browse wrap to click wrap is 0.14%. That's a little over a tenth of a percent, so it's almost nothing. Another interesting observation is the amount of time spent on these contracts. The median time spent on these EULAs that are an average 23 words long is 29 and 58 seconds. Again, not nearly enough time to read or understand it, or perhaps just realize that, oops, I clicked on the wrong page. So again, the number of the time spent is very, very low. I use several methods of estimating who a shopper is and what a shopping session is. Some are very conservative, some are less conservative, but the of all the methods that I explain in the paper, the average rate, the average increase in reading on going from browse wraps with obscure disclosure to click wraps, the most prominent one, is 0.36%. So again, no matter how I cut it, the number is still under 1%. It's very, very low. The results are robust when I run regressions controlling for all sorts of things, of all product characteristics, company characteristics, different definitions of shopping visits. The numbers stay roughly the same. So the results are rather robust. For the time sakes, I just tell you like this in a slide. So what I do next is I said, well, perhaps requiring buyers to acknowledge a EULA through a click wrap on a scroll book. So now maybe buyers are way too lazy and they don't want to click on that extra link, even though they know they're agreeing to something. So how about we study the most salient EULAs, the ones that are the ones favored by the best practices of the principles, and see whether perhaps we have a better luck with these types of contracts. As I said earlier, I can't really tell whether people access these contracts or not, because they're right there. But what I can do, what I can observe, is the amount of time people spend on these contracts. Keep in mind that these pages are usually very complicated and require consumers to fill in all sorts of personal information, so the amount of time spent should also take into account all that extra activity on the page. So what do I find? That people don't really read click wraps with scroll boxes either. The median time spent on these pages is at most 94 seconds. So great, a minute and a half. It seems like a small of a victory, but we must also keep in mind that there's all sorts of tasks that consumers must do, and that, again, that the average UL length is over 2,000 words, and that the just to put it in context, the average adult reading speed is 275 words per minute, and this is for non-legal technical stuff. So basically, we would need just 8 minutes to read the EULA, and we don't see that ever happening. So the bottom line of these findings is that even with required assent, in the sense of making consumers agree to things, and salient disclosure, almost nobody reads fine print. People just ignore these things and move on. Now, that being said, there's some things that the paper cannot say. So I can say something about whether increased disclosure increases readership, but I can't say, for instance, whether mandatory disclosure will affect terms. So if sellers think that some consumers read, maybe that's good enough. Maybe sellers that feel that now that they have to post the terms on the license, they might be discovered and they might be disciplined into offering good terms, that might do the trick, although it seems rather uncertain. And that's just particularly true because in a previous paper, I find that there is absolutely no relationship by how saliently or disclosed or how hidden the contract is. Even terms that are available after purchase are no more biased than terms that are right on your face. So there's absolutely no relationship between contract bias and disclosure. The second thing that I can't say at this point is whether the fact that nobody reads fine print, like I can say that, but the fact that nobody reads it doesn't necessarily prove that terms are bad. Maybe there are other market mechanisms at play that are constraining sellers, but what I can say is, regardless of this question, if disclosure doesn't rate readership, why focus so much on this approach? So what is the conclusion from this study is that requiring disclosure seems, like a sensible solution, but it's unlikely to make any difference at all. Hardly anybody reads, regardless of disclosure, and those who do read spend very, very little time on them to fully understand or make decisions based on what they read. And the indirect conclusion that I get from this is that what appears to be costly is not really the accessing the contract, but actually reading it. It seems that it's not that it's finding the contract, but rather actually taking the time to read. So the other point that I'd like to make is that ineffective regulation is not costless. Yes, it's true, disclosure doesn't really create that many distortions, but adding a step to the checkout process might reduce transactions because consumers are very impatient online. But more importantly, adopting a regime that doesn't really work might forestall real change, because maybe a lot of people are led into thinking that something is working and things are changing when in fact they're not. And again, as noted several times by the drafters of the principles, is that courts might be more lax into enforcing suspicious terms if they think that disclosure is actually working. Well, this seller is complying, and so perhaps the terms are reasonable. So these are all real concerns. So the question is, well, now what? What are the potential solutions? Well, one of them is to reduce or maybe go a little further, reduce the cost of becoming inform, maybe shorten contracts or standardize them. There's like the food labels have worked fairly well in several contexts. I know Omri has a couple of wonderful papers on this, developing ratings, anything that greatly reduces the cost of becoming informed, that doesn't require reading pages and pages of contract. Another possibility is that maybe it's not worthwhile for anybody to read, and we don't want people to spend the time reading, but if that's the case, maybe we want to reduce the cost of seeking redress ex post. Maybe we want to reconsider forum selection clauses and class action waivers, and I know the drafters of the principles have done so. And maybe something that is uncomfortable and hard to think about, but if there is indeed a problem, maybe we don't want to get direct regulation of terms right off the table. If disclosure as a solution for solving market failures isn't effective, maybe it's something that we might want to consider down the line. And finally, maybe we don't want to do anything if we don't think there's a problem. So I think it's important to keep on finding for looking for problems. And this is what I'm trying to do in current work. But anyway, that's my paper. Thank you. Now I'd love to hear you, because I feel like I'm talking just in my office in an empty room.
Moss, no waivers. Can you hear us?
I can barely hear.
Oh,
all right. Oh, there I go. I had very low volume. It was my fault.
You hear him now?
I can hear you perfectly.
She can hear now. She had her volume down.
Yes. It was me. It was me.
Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, I
will threat to your papers.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Well, I have to say it doesn't come as a huge surprise to me that people don't read these terms. But I guess the real question is suggested maybe in your last set of PowerPoint bullets, right? So what is it that makes us think of this as a contract at all? Right. I post a bunch of words on the website that I know no one will read.
We call those academic papers.
Exactly. Right. And much as I would like everyone to be bound, even though they didn't read them, to the terms of my academic papers, it would be silly for me to suggest that they are. Right. We have a set of legal default rules for what happens in contractual relationships. Parties can, by entering into an agreement, change those default rules, but I guess I'm not sure what it is we think about this makes it an agreement if no one is reading it and no one even has to sort of go through the fiction of saying that we read it even though we didn't.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point, and I think it's a valid question, and perhaps what we should be talking about. I think that what my results show is that trying to recreate the fiction, trying to have, and I know that the principles at some point say, well, click wraps are what most closely resemble traditional forms of offer and acceptance, you know, this mutual acknowledgement that you're entering into an agreement. But if everybody ignores it, and nobody pays attention to it, and nobody really sees it as a contract, I don't know what people think, but at least they're just just cruising through this as if it was just getting to an end goal, which is a product. Then we why bother with this fiction if in reality it doesn't mean anything? And I guess this is a question of the principles also. And then I know Bob is raising his hand. Is this idea of preserving the opportunity to read? And I know Omri has a wonderful paper on this. But what's the value of it if nobody really uses it, and perhaps online, nobody really thinks of this as a contract. As a small indirect, I'm working on a paper. It's on very sophisticated parties, where a company, an electronic trading platform, used to make people agree to a paper contract, and it would take several rounds of negotiation until finally they put that same contract online as a click wrap, and the click wrap said, you don't have to agree to this, we're happy to negotiate, nobody ever negotiated anything, and everybody just clicked on I agree. So the idea of what, even though the text is the same, the stakes are the same, these are highly sophisticated parties, millions of dollars at stake, by putting something on the web and making you click I agree, all of a sudden this idea that you're entering into a contract, it seems, I haven't finalized my study, disappears. So I agree with you that, do we really want to think about whether this is a contract or not, or whether this is a voluntary agreement or not? What I'm saying here, and it's a question that merits a lot more thought than what I'm giving now, but what I'm saying here is that creating a fiction or making consumers go through a click wrap doesn't really create the idea of a contract that we have traditionally had in mind. And I agree with you, and that is a problem if sellers aren't constrained by other means, absolutely. Yes, Bob, hi, how are you?
Hi, and congratulations on your baby too. So,
thank you, I can't wait. I can barely walk.
maybe you'll be busy with the baby and not have as much time to attack.
Then I'll agree to everything online. I'll be sleep deprived.
And I'll save some of my comments because, as you know, I go next in this. But I just wanted to react to this idea that the standard form may not be a contract, and ask the question, what would it be and how would it be enforced? The software vendors that I spoke with over the years would go absolutely crazy if they were told these terms that you're putting on the net are not a contract. There's going to have to be some other vehicle for determining what's enforceable or not. Freedom of contract is down the drain. So I'm just wondering either what you or Mark think would be the legal alternative structure.
Yeah, and that's a million-dollar question. So everything has a question mark in my last slide. I don't know if you noticed that. on purpose, everything does. Of course, I'm not saying let's impose mandatory terms right now. I just said, assuming there is a problem, and after very careful study and realizing that perhaps that other methods of disclosure doesn't work. For example, shortening the contract, simplifying, making consumers more aware of certain terms. I don't think people consider terms in software license agreements in making their purchase decisions, such as they don't consider the terms, many of them in privacy policies when navigating the web. If all else fails and there's a problem, and that might take a while to figure out, then we might want to think of other things. And what those things are, I don't know. I also know that software vendors would go crazy. I agree with you that they would go crazy if everybody would have to agree to a standardized agreement. But if nothing else works, and if disclosure fails, and I don't know, and ratings fails, and labels fail, and everything else fails, then I think we have to start thinking a little bit harder about what to do. And what I'm suggesting is, I'm not advocating that right now. I'm not saying let's abandon the contract. I'm all for choice, but I'm also willing to acknowledge the elephant in the room, which is disclosure. As wonderful as it sounds, and as easy and comfortable as we all feel with it, if it doesn't work in any way, Then that it might force us to tackle much harder questions, which is the one that you are. And maybe in a few years we'll be having a conference of what those things are. And I'm happy to think about them. I can't say it right now.
Florencia, Richard Epstein is the dying.
Richard.
Look, as somebody who is absolutely thrilled and content with the current legal regime, who clicks with the rapidity. There is another way in which you could try to test this, which is presumably there are ex post some disputes. And the question is, apart from the formation issue, do we see in the resolution of those disputes an appeal to any other norms other than the contract, or any widespread dissatisfaction with the ways in which these contracts are termed by parties to it, even if they're sophisticated buyers. I mean, it would be nice to know, A, what the rate of disputes are, and B, the sense of legitimacy that people have in customer service or similar kinds of things afterwards. And my experience about this is that the cookware business is no different from the shopping business. You know, you don't like the way the lingerie looks, you call them up, you say it bleeds and runs, and then you make some kind of a deal as to whether or not you can return it. So I just think that you're worrying about solving a problem which doesn't exist, because for that, it turns out you'll never find a very good solution. So I think you're being much too kind to the opposition.
Well, that could be the case, and as I said, in this slide, no readers doesn't prove terms are bad. Maybe things happen outside the contract. Maybe the contract doesn't matter at all, and it's just used to deal with too squeaky a wheel. And in that sense, I can't really say. What I can say, and what we did try to measure in a previous paper, was whether word of mouth or blogs, you know, this whole Facebook thing, you know, there's one person who complains and all of a sudden sellers get, it's slightly different than the point you made, which is making an individual call. A lot of people feel that they can call and change their terms, but there's been some interesting experimental work showing that the initial contract that you get gives you a particular feeling about the entitlements that you have, and contracts that are much more, and this was done with leases a while ago, that contracts that are much more restrictive, people feel less entitled to complain. But that being said, yes, maybe there is no problem, and everything's fine. But if there is no problem, then why focus on disclosure anyway? No matter what the result is. It doesn't make that much of a difference. One of the things that I did find in another study that I'm doing is that over the last 7 years, software contracts have gotten significantly worse. The restrictions to buyers are much more pervasive, and what I imagine that perhaps with reputation terms get better, but terms actually get worse. That doesn't really deny your claim that perhaps people that complain get whatever they want. Now, sellers who are not constrained by reputation might not care enough, but I can't say, it's an empirical question whether that happens or not at a rate high enough so that we don't have to worry about anything. And I don't have an answer to that, but I do know that it could go either way. Hi, Omri, how are you?
Hi, I want to ask you actually about some of the mechanics of your study, not only around your study, but the internal works. So one of the findings that you have, I think you can, you know, I kind of, I'm the last person to challenge the spirit of what you're finding, but I think you can tighten some of the things a bit more, and so why not? One of
yes,
the findings that you report is that on those checkout click wraps and the people that have the terms there, you get a median or an average of 94 seconds,
yes,
which is much more substantial than what we see otherwise. And there could be two hypotheses, and you haven't ruled out. One is people just are busy filling in their credit card information and do not look at all of the terms. And the other is people only read the terms, decide that they are really bad, and walk away from the deal. The second would mean that disclosure is doing its work. Now, I don't think that that's what you will find, but you have not ruled out that possibility, and you do see a striking increase of presence around these terms when you use a click wrap. And I think that you might want to find a way to rule out the second possibility that people read and walk away from the deal because they realize that, oh, after 7 years, terms have gotten so bad, they don't want to purchase. One of the things that you can probably do is there are many of these click wraps, these pages, that do not involve filling in credit card numbers. I get once or twice a week software updates for, you know, Firefox, Microsoft, and the like, and iTunes. And there you just have to, you know, read and click I agree and install. And there is no other thing that you can really do on that particular URL or that particular page. I don't know if you have that kind of clickstream data, but need to isolate those pages in which the only thing you do is supposedly reading and see whether in the click wrap scenario you still get those 94 seconds or is it back down to the same thing that you see with browser.
That's very helpful. And I could do that, and it's something I don't do. In another paper that's, this paper had some word limitations that I'm very proud that they complied with. I think I'm under 500 or so. But one of the things that I excluded, and I have in a much more general paper dealing with increased disclosure and accessibility, is I study purchase behavior as a function of contract quality. And I do focus on these zero EULAs, on these EULAs, scroll box EULAs as well. And what I do find is that people are equally likely to buy regardless of how buyer or seller friendly the EULA is. So that addresses your point. So I was concerned about that too. Well, maybe those 94 seconds, maybe people have these autofill, right? Like home info, and it fills it immediately. But it doesn't seem that people are being swayed by what they read. And there's such few readers that I can actually study very, very in a lot of detail what it is that they do. And whether they comparison shop, for example, you know, those people who the text box, do they go somewhere else? Nobody did. Nobody checked anything. Nobody checked blogs. And nobody seemed to be affected by the terms of the contract, even among when there were differences within competing products. So that might address your question, that the 94 seconds are spent going to your wallet and figuring out what your credit card number is. Hi, behind Omri, I don't.
Randy Picker. Hi, Florencia. I don't think we're thinking about this in the right way. I don't think we care about average behavior. I think we care about tail behavior. Right? So the Facebook example you offered is a very good one, right? So if 1 in 10,000 people read the contract, that person spends a lot of time on it, and that person is able to broadcast that effectively, that may be sufficient. So all the mean figures I see in front of me don't care in the slightest, right? I know that the denominator there, the people who spend no time, is going to drive that down. What I care about is the existence of 1 person in 10,000, 1 in 20,000, who reads it seriously and broadcasts. Right? And that's what the disclosure regime may make possible.
Should I take another question? No. The Facebook example is wonderful. Of course, the Facebook is a very hot company today. But for every Facebook, there's hundreds of sellers that people actually complain and rant about. And I read all the blog entries. I actually have a student doing a study of the effectiveness of these sole 1 in 1,000 crusaders, and for the most part, they're stories of failure. People complaining in blogs, and for the consumerist to pick it up, and then for the New York Times to pick it up and make a big stink about it, it's a very high low probability indeed. I think companies like Microsoft and Facebook, companies that are newsworthy, might, and Google are kept in check by very, very few readers, but many companies don't have that profile.
We can't really understand what disclosure does without having a better feel for that propagation mechanism. Some successes, some failures, and we need to sort through what works and why.
Yes, it's true, and I have a student doing that. The successes are few and far between, but at least what I do in this paper, and at least what the principals had in mind, and this is a different mechanism, is that increased disclosure will promote the creation of an informed minority of buyers is not going to happen. And this idea of blogs propagating and as present as Facebook is in our minds, people are not reading these blogs so much. They do read the New York Times if it comes out there, but they're not reading the blogs, which are many, many that deal with bad software terms. There's even a program that's offered for free called the EULAlyzer that you install, and it tells you all the problems there with your EULA. Nobody goes to this site. Nobody downloads this free software.
Sorry, can I follow up on this really quickly?
I think I may be off camera.
No, you're off camera, but you're always.
Sorry, Florencia, yeah, Jonathan Macer. If Randy's right that the way to solve this problem is to have some sort of an intermediary who is scrutinizing these things for all the people who are not reading, and you're quite persuasive that nobody's reading, and persuasive that then nobody's going to read the blogs. So maybe plaintiff's attorneys can sort of fulfill that role as an intermediary. So obviously they're not going to allow people to make sort of sensible consumer decisions between products, but at least they might set a floor for these terms. such that nothing gets too highly out of whack. So in that sense, it doesn't really matter if anyone bothers posting to that blog or if anyone bothers reading the blog about who's got good terms and who's got bad terms. At least someone out there is sort of scrolling through these things and policing to make sure that they're not too onerous to consumers, and we can count on plaintiffs' attorneys to sort of perform that role. And in that sense, just as Randy suggested, enough disclosure to make that at least cheap to do is worthwhile in some respects, even if very, very few people are reading it.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I'm also not against blogs or anything. All I'm saying is that making everything into a click wrap is not gonna, I don't think is gonna change all these things from happening. I think that perhaps with plaintiff's attorneys, we might wanna think about class action waivers. So this is part of the ex post mechanism. I think if people don't find it worthwhile to read, we might certainly wanna think about ex post mechanisms. But I'm worried that by having a regime where we have this belief that by having click wraps, we're recreating the traditional contract notion of assent, there's going to be a change and people are going to be informed and they're going to read, that might be a problem perhaps with some courts. And that's what I worry about. I think that intermediaries and ratings are wonderful, and I think there are ways in which people can become informed at very, very little cost. And I know Omri has talked about this, and I'm in full agreement. I just don't think that as I said, my concern, I'm not against disclosure. My concern is that the belief that disclosure will do something that it cannot do will forestall real change and create some problems. And it's very clear that disclosure doesn't really work in the way that we'd like it to work. Thanks, I appreciate the person moving the camera.
Hi, Florence. So it might be that, you know, we want people to read these things, you know, whether there are other mechanisms for solving these problems as well, right? And so I wonder to what extent we might, I mean, you can't do it with this data because you only have, you know, 7 responses to the click wrap license. But I wonder if
we have a year worth of data, I could go crazy.
Right. So my question is, you know, to what extent can we disaggregate kind of different aspects of click wrap licenses, right? So might there be, you know, because small numbers could make a difference here. So are there differences between opt-ins and opt-outs, right, where you have to click or unclick the license? I know my IRB now wants me, in order to kind of advance pages in my IRB protocol, I have to actually scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page before I can click I agree, right, because they want to encourage me to read these things, right, even though I can answer the questions without reading them. Right, so to what extent might various other technological fixes create differences within the click wrap style of licenses themselves, right? Do opt-ins or opt-outs make differences? Are there other types of technological fixes that could still encourage people to sometimes read?
Yes, I don't know that. I know that having to scroll down more doesn't really increase time spent. Maybe an extra second for having to do that, but it doesn't really force people. It doesn't really induce people to spend time reading the contract. But yes, I know that the principals discuss clicking on every single term, and. I don't know, do we want everybody to click on 50 terms for every single transaction that they do maybe for some terms that are really salient, but what if I want to ignore at the forum selection clause? What if I don't care? And I can see a whole new set of programs coming up that click for you and you don't have to deal with it at all. You know, people can get over these things if they don't want to deal with them. But sure, technology is certainly a way to deal with these issues of consumer ignorance. I think that the key is to lower, at least my view at this point from what I've studied, is that a lot of people don't want to be bothered, and the people who might just don't understand and get frustrated, these contracts are really, really long. So it's not about putting them more in your face, maybe it's about making them nicer and shorter and easier to digest, or perhaps having an intermediary telling you, you know, this contract is a D or thumbs down, or because we know Moody's work so well. but the role of an intermediary might reduce the cost enough so that all of a sudden the contract becomes something that consumers can take into account when making their decision instead of fully ignoring it because they just can't deal with the complexity and the cost is just not worthwhile. Yes.
Not sure what they asked, but I'll take it. I'm Chris Frigman. So, extension of Chris's comment. So I can imagine courts thinking differently about assent depending on what the contract provision says. So here's a couple of examples from copyright. So you have in EULAs things like reverse engineering prohibition provisions. So there's a fair use doctrine in the copyright law, and then the EULA says you can't take advantage of what might otherwise be fair use rights to reverse engineer. Or there are ways in which EULAs are structured that create contract conditions rather than contract covenants. So when some behavior violates the contract, it turns into a copyright infringement as well. And often, you know, whether it's a condition or covenant is just a matter of the way the contract is worded. So things like that, where, you know, assent is actually pretty important because it toggles between two very, very different states of the world and actually pushes, in the case of fair use, against a public policy of part of the United States Code, that might be an area where, you know, you could mount an argument for a more robust disclosure requirement, right? Because there, the idea of assent as a fiction may be a little bit more offensive than, say, a forum selection clause, which affects only the person concerned. So I wonder if you thought about those aspects of dualism, whether you can, you know, think of an argument where these things get cut a little more fine.
Yeah, I guess that would go to the next step in saying, well, maybe there's a particular set of terms where we want people to be more aware of and you know put it out there more. I know that, for instance, the Federal Trade Commission has been having very similar problems with privacy. They don't know which terms to pick. They know that there are some that are extremely important and they just don't know how to cut it because he's like, otherwise, well, just do a label for it. Labels have worked wonderfully well. And with software, it's equally problematic because for the most part, users are just gonna install the software and just do what the program does. So a few of them will wanna modify the program or reverse engineer, and reverse engineering clauses are basically 95% of the contracts that I've seen at. And it's true, it might trigger different sets of rights. And I don't know yet how to make that selection, if we ever came to that. But that would be something to think about. You know, which are the terms? You know, pick your top three. Which are the terms? Because you can't do everything that we want people to factor in, or the majority of people to factor in with it. Decision, or maybe not. Or we might want to deal with exposed, as in a previous comment, because there's also exposed redress. Or we might have Richard's point of having people individually negotiate their own deal. But that's an excellent point, and I agree. It's something that needs to be thought about, and I don't have an answer yet.
We have time for one more short question and answer.
Sir Becky.
Yes, hello, Florencia Becky Eisenberg. The one way that I guess what you're basically asking here is whether we want to rely on enforceable agreements or something else, like reputation or regulation, in order to handle disputes if and when they arise. The problem is that the agreement terms just aren't salient to consumers. One way, in another context where the terms of agreement sometimes become salient, even when they're bad terms of agreements, is when the seller offers you a better deal. And in the bricks and mortar world, this is becoming ubiquitous. You know, you buy a car, you think you've negotiated your deal for your car, and then they say, well, we can offer you a much better warranty. And then you say, well, wait a minute, what's the matter with the warranty that we just bargained over? And the same thing happens even when you're buying fairly small things at a big box store, and they'll ask you, do you want to get the extended service agreement, or do you want to pay a little bit more in order to get a better deal for aspects of the package that you didn't even think about? Is anything anything like that happening with these EULAs, and do you have any theory as to why it wouldn't happen or isn't happening?
This is one of the most puzzling things. So I did check for that. I said, well, maybe, you know, the software doesn't say anything, but people in their site are saying we have a longer warranty. And this is particularly salient with, for example, tax estimation software, because some companies offer a full warranty or a guarantee if, for example, because of a bug or a problem, you pay your taxes incorrectly and you're fined. Some of these companies say, we'll pay it. Others don't at all. Now, the companies who say it only say so in their, some of the companies only say so in their EULA that nobody reads. And I was just shocked. And companies
so
that also
have hidden in EULAs too.
Yes, and I said, great, I should use this company because I know it. Companies have, some of them have some pretty extensive warranties. Some don't even have limitations on damage. I think that might be mostly an oversight. But even those that have more extensive warranties, very generous for the standards of the industry, which is basically to disclaim absolutely everything, they're not advertised at all. So when I send emails to sellers and I ask them, you know, you have this extremely generous warranty that if there's a bug or a problem, you know, it's going to cost you a lot. Why don't you advertise it? And they just don't think about it. Small sellers think of their software as an art, and there's things that they feel promise, and some things that they can't, and they just don't think that way. I wonder whether the firms that have legal counsel, how do they think? But all those firms actually take everything away. So I didn't see it, and it's something that I looked for because I thought maybe people learn through advertising. Cell phone companies are doing it, car companies are doing it, software companies are not doing it.
Well, Florencia, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome to stay with us if technology allows in your time, but...
I'd love to stay, but maybe they can erase my face from the board because I'll take my PowerPoint away and then I'll see all my messy desktop. So I don't know how the technology works, but I'd love to stay.
Check your EULA.
Yes.